Welcome to the SICK Network Podcast, a weekly podcast discussing current and topical issues affecting SICKs across the global diaspora.
Welcome back to the SICK Network Podcast. You join us all for episode 24. Once again, I think it's been a 2 week break since the last one, but obviously a lot's been going on. And once again, this episode 24 will be kind of full packed with all the kind of information and kind of credible discussion, as we've displayed in the previous 23, should I say. Before we go on to the kind of narrative for today's episode, once again, if, you know, we urge kind of, I suppose, we helping hand from our listeners to share this podcast as widely as possible. And also, if you like what you hear, you know, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and all the other platforms as well. It would just help with our visibility and obviously the amount of people that listen to what we talk about. So episode 24. Today, I'm joined by, our usual regulars, Jaz Singh, founder of the SICK Network, and Mangkamal Singh, member of the SICK Network and an author for various publications, including the Ilford Recorder. But we're joined today by our special guest is from an organization who are very much rooted in what is going on in Punjab on a day-to-day basis. You know, all the issues that Punjabis are suffering from and Punjab as a land is suffering from. The organization is Saving Punjab, and I'm delighted to be joined by Gurpreet Singh from Saving Punjab. So everyone, Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa.
Waheguru
Ji Ki Fateh. Gurpreet, really appreciate you taking the time to join us. I know we were just talking just before we started, me and Jaz, when we bumped into you in Smethwick, about, you know, getting you onto the show, and it's great that we've followed that up. So really want to start for the viewers, Gurpreet, by, you know, you introducing Saving Punjab as an organization, where it originated from, what the concept was, and I suppose, you know, what are the sort of the key projects that you guys are kind of working with at the moment.
So thank you. Hopefully you can hear me clearly. Just to kind of start off, I just want to say thank you for inviting me on and having me on this discussion. So Saving Punjab, just to kind of put it into a nutshell, I'd say, is a research-based educational organization using both primary and secondary data to understand kind of the key core issues, to understand the magnitude and the scale of the issues in Punjab. To kind of put that in kind of simple words, when you have something wrong with your car, you take it to a garage, and the first thing the mechanic does is he says, okay, I'm going to diagnose the problem. Only then I can say you need these parts and this is what needs fixing on your car. At the moment, we all know Punjab's, you know, suffering with many, many issues, whether that's the drug issue, the social issues, the environmental issues. But where do we start? How do we start to tackle the issue in Punjab? And I think that comes back down to the research, understanding, having the data. And kind of, I think we really undervalue research as a Qaum, as a Panth, and as a kind of Punjabi people. We don't understand kind of how research could really benefit on understanding how we could work more efficiently. Just the core principles of our organization, our prevention is better than the cure. So if there's cancer in Punjab, we want to be making sure that there is no cancer rather than giving aid. We want to make sure that, you know, to find the root cause of that cancer and what's causing. That's just one example. But like, just to kind of give you an example, Germany as a country spent, you know, 1.4 billion on its research and development. And countries out there use, businesses out there use research to understand, what product the market needs. You know, many NGOs out there understand and use research so that they know that the kind of, you know, whatever they are giving in terms of aid is efficient and there is no kind of waste somewhere. And, you know, the data-led approach always kind of helps you understanding kind of targeted interventions where you need to prioritize. You know, if there's correlation with sets of data, kind of before I go off on a tangent, I'm going to just stop there. And I'm sure like, there's, you know, some.
No, I mean, that was really interesting. And one thing that's sort of popped out to me is you're talking about data and finding kind of primary data. And we can all probably relate to it to an element in the Western world of research and data. But how difficult, Gurpreet, is this level of data? You know, how hard is it to come by from Punjab? You know, because we know there's various restrictions in Punjab and a variety of information. How easy is it to get this data you guys are playing with?
So there's both the quantitative and qualitative data, the secondary and primary data. It's there's plenty of it on secondary databases, academic databases. How accountable it is, I mean, for anything to be academically peer-reviewed and kind of, you know, for it to be passed on an academic journal, it needs to go through kind of, you know, the kind of scrutiny and the policies of making sure that it's credible. So I think the data out there is credible. The governmental data that they, you know, either release in the Lok Sabha or in their kind of census is, you know, you have to take that with a little bit of kind of caution. I'll give you an example of a set of data that, you know, we kind of came across that, you know, showed that how government doesn't really show the correct kind of data. So from 2000 to 2015, the governmental data showed with farmer suicides in Punjab that there was around 3,600. So this is from 2000 to 2015. The university, this is the governmental data. The universities did their independent investigation. So that was Guru Nanak Dev University, Punjab Agricultural University. There was another university as well, three universities. And their findings for 2000 to 2015 for the same amount of years was 16,606. So you could see a huge difference between the governmental data and the data. And similarly, there's been kind of similar findings. So we, in 2020, just when lockdown happened, started something called the MyPrint survey. And we had around 15,000 people fill that survey out. And the idea of the survey was for people sitting in the diaspora and sitting in Punjab to give us primary data of what's going on in their village, to kind of give us an indication of where the hotspots are of certain issues, if there is kind of intervention where it needs to be targeted. And from that information that we pulled out, that data, that raw data, there were so many things that, you know, we thought were a problem. Like, for example, top of my head, 86% of people that filled the survey out said that there's a drug issue in their village. And around 65% of that 86% said that they knew of someone that had a fatality due to drugs in their village. I mean, that was just the drugs, whether it was the migration issue, that was 2 years ago. People are saying, look, people are leaving, pindas are becoming empty. And now we're seeing that happening now. We're seeing that the pindas are practically empty in Punjab and many, many other issues. And we did a few things with that data. We held a think tank event with the World Sikh Parliament, which Saving Punjab is a part of the Education Council of that. And we held this think tank event where we called many organizations and did the data share of, look, this is what the data's showing. If you are doing work in Punjab, whether that's humanitarian work, use this data and work more efficiently. Use the data to target where you want to do a drugs camp or where you need to put some intervention in place.
I think that's the key thing, isn't it, right? Is that if you think about people who have been either from Punjab or organizations here that are working for Punjab or raising the concerns or issues in the plight of Punjab, you hear about those issues around the drug and alcohol epidemic there, the debt-ridden plight of farmers, and that came to light with the whole farmers protest. And we've heard about the river and the waters issue and Punjab being sort of drained from its own resources. And the lack of education. These things you hear at a very high level, that Punjab is becoming a desert, it's losing its water, it's its drugs. And then you have the other issues that you talk about as well around the health, which I think is probably under under-discussed as a real impact. We all know people, family members who get ill and have to go into the hospital systems and the government systems there, and it's a huge expense. And some of them are misdiagnosed, and you never really know what's happening there. And you talk about the religious side as well, which probably had the dominant factor, certainly in recent times. But I guess the key thing of what Saving Punjab, I guess, is bringing is, like you said, Godfrey, is the data, the fact-based and data-driven assessment and analysis that you can stand up against, whether it's human rights organizations, whether it's global United Nations, any organization operating those five spheres. You can actually take the data you've pulled together and have it there in front of someone, and even compared with other regions, other countries in the regions, other global areas, and say, right, how is this being going unnoticed, and on what is the sort of recovery plan for this stuff? And this is why Punjabis and Sikhs of Punjab are, what you're seeing is the extreme reaction to it, but you're not seeing the systematic breakdown of Punjab that's been happening on a whole level, social, health, education. And they've gotten away with it. The center state have gotten away with this for the last four, probably 70 years, I'd say, since independence, that there's been this psychological genocide of Punjab. And when you look at the notes, and anyone on this podcast, I'd urge them to sort of go on savingpunjab.org, the website, and on the social media, and read the stuff that's on there. There's articles, there's press releases, there's small facts which just give you the situation there. And like you said, Godfrey, it's fact-based. It's from primary and secondary data. It's not somebody just making up as they go along or their opinion. And I think that's just really vital that we touch on some of these things and go into these in detail, because the stats is what's startling. And as you say, when everyone knows someone from a family who's impacted by drugs, but when you put the numbers there, it really brings it home.
It does. I think that's what's required. It's this shift from anecdotal sort of discussion to real fact-based, evidence-based, data-based discussion, which is so important. I mean, you've got to think, you know, you talked about partition in this last 70 years. I mean, we've been an unstable form for a period of time. You know, we've had to battle a lot for survival. So in that transition phase, you know, unfortunately, research, data gathering and those kind of things do get parked.
To kind of give an idea of the shocking state that I kind of, you know, had to witness of what's going on in Punjab. When I first started looking into it, I was thinking, you know, how does this, you know, get so bad, and not many people know about how actually bad the situation is. And I think many Punjabis at the moment probably still don't know how bad the situation is. I'll give you like a statistic that I think some people might be able to find it hard to comprehend. So the general population of India is around 2 billion. I think might be slightly under 2 billion at the moment.
It's about 1.6 billion
or so. And Punjab's population from that is about 1.9% in terms of its population. Around 28 million people. In the whole of India, those people that are in jail for the NDPD Act, so that's for narcotics in drugs, in the whole of India, how many people do you think are in jail for drugs? It might be, you know, in the millions, it might be 100 million or what, out of, you know, the billions that are in there. It will be 100 million. I'd say it'd probably be maybe 5 or 6 million that are in jail for drugs. Out of them people that are in jail for drugs, 44% of them are from Punjab. That's from the entire country. That's from
less than 2% population of a community.
Absolutely. A 1.53% geographical area, a tiny little state, and they contribute to 44.4% of those people that are in jail for drugs. Last year's reports, Punjab came the first in the narcotics acts. It came third in overdose. It came the second highest in illicit alcohol consumption deaths. Like the statistics will then start making you understand, like, oh wow, from 2011 to 2014, there was around 13,800 tons of drugs found in the whole of India. And from this tiny 1.53 geographical area, 50% of the drugs were found in that tiny space.
From your work, right, have you sort of looked and explored in terms of where that's all come from? Because obviously Punjab sits on a border state with Pakistan, and we all know that whilst it's been probably the most heavily militarized border, one of the heavily militarized borders on the planet, you get all of this drug traffic flowing through and landing in Punjab. And from the research you've done, where is it? Is it being funneled in, like the alcohol? What's the data supporting that in terms of the origination of it?
So there's a few reports on that. There's a drugs and war crime report by the UN. There's the CIA that have released a document, which is the international drug trafficking around the world. And both have highlighted this this area called the Golden Crescent. And the doorway to that Golden Crescent, I mean, anyone can go away and research this, is Punjab. And Punjab supplies the drugs. It's like the doorway to Asia, they say. And the problem I find with the findings, and I looked at this in quite a lot of detail, the problem I have with the findings is, like you just said, Punjab's border is so heavily militarized. How are the drugs coming across the border in Punjab? But Gujarat and Rajasthan have a border size probably triple the size of Punjab, and there's no drugs coming from that area.
And probably a percent of the military there.
And there's, yeah, exactly. So as in, you know, if they are coming from Pakistan or Afghanistan or wherever they're coming from, the question is, it's been happening for the last 20 to 30 years. You know, where is the intervention? Why the neglect? Is it intentional drugs that have been sent into Punjab? And also, a lot of the drugs that are, you know, kind of used in Punjab now are synthetic drugs. And there's an article, really good article online, that talks about the synthetic drugs are created in laboratories. And most of these are in Delhi and UP. And they are kind of coming, the drugs that are coming into Punjab are coming from Delhi and other states like that. So as in, there's no clear evidence of where these drugs are coming from, but we all know politicians, the police, the peddlers are all kind of in on it.
That scale of operation cannot exist without the authorities' complicity. I mean, it's just impossible to have in that, like you said, that small area of land in such a vast country with the military presence there, with the threat from Kashmir, and the constant inflated threat from Sikhs, the central government places. No way can they have this level of drug operation, distribution, without the government being involved or the police being absolutely directly involved.
So we've got a few researchers with us at the moment, and we're kind of building our team. We're only like 2 years old at the moment. And a few of our researchers are doing, one of them is doing research in drugs, the other one's, on social issues, on health issues, mental health issues. And they're kind of formulating reports and looking secondary data, crunching it. And it's kind of, we're all volunteers, but, it's understanding what the issue is. And I was helping one of my researchers look into certain things. And I started looking at the research of what the other states in India are like, especially those states where there has been a separatist movement or there's been something that has been against the central government. And there's a pattern, there's a huge pattern with those places that have had some kind of insurgency and drugs or alcohol and issues with crime and gangs. So that, it's something that I'm further looking at, but I only looked at one state in a bit of depth, and that was Kashmir. And if anyone that doesn't believe me, just look at the statistics for the Srinagar Drug Rehabilitation Center in the last 3 years, since the Article 370 was removed, and what's been happening in Kashmir. There's been around a 2,000% increase within the drugs of Kashmir, around 600,000 youths. It's huge what's happening in Kashmir at the moment, especially with the drugs. There was a report that was published earlier this year in January about dementia. There was the India's largest dementia screening. And this dementia screening talked about the highest place of dementia in the entire country was Kashmir. And there's a direct link with dementia and post-traumatic stress disorder. And the study went on to say that, you know, people in Kashmir, 60-year-olds, 11% of anyone over 60 has got dementia. And that statistic was huge. And then it went on to saying that an average adult in Kashmir had witnessed 7 traumatic incidents in their life. And, you know, the statistics kind of show for themselves, whether it is to do with Kashmir's drug issue, whether it is to do with Kashmir, you know, and having these mental health issues and other health issues. And the third one was fertility rates. That's a really interesting one throughout India, to look at the fertility rates, especially in those states where there has been insurgency, and to look at this kind of the middle Hindu belt and seeing how the fertility rates in that area is flourishing, you know, at 1.9 or 2.0, whereas Punjab's like the lowest in the country at 1.3, and Kashmir is following by 1.4. You know, it's concerning that the picture that you see day by day growing in Punjab, it is becoming more and more concerning.
Is it, you know, it's just shocking, some of the stats that you're putting out.
Yeah.
There. Do you think that there is this element of, I mean, there is this, what you're mentioning doesn't surprise us in the sense that we're sort of aware of it in a minor way, I suppose, without the stats and without the actual real evidence. So we're sort of aware that there has been this sort of cultural genocide, or there's been this religious genocide that's been taking place in a softer way, not such a hard way, over the last 20 years. But do you think there's a cover up as well by us as the community? You know, we cover up the drugs issue, we cover up, we're a bit concerned. So we when you go to Punjab, you'll see obviously people there just trying to say it's not as bad as it looks or whatnot. Do you experience any of that?
I'm gonna kind of, the biggest problem I say in Punjab at the moment is the fact that our river water was diverted. And I think a lot of the issues that we face today stem from that river water being diverted. You know, I think we fought a whole struggle because of that river water. The Punjabi Subalair was kind of indirectly because of that Pani. So they trifurcated Punjab and left Bakra, which is the dam that stops Punjab's water coming into Punjab. In 1966, the Reorganization Act left that dam outside of Punjab intentionally. And I think, like, at the moment, if you speak to a Punjabi, they say, Pani de nal koi, we ain't got an issue with water, because when we turn the tube well on, Pani's coming. We just need to bore a few deeper every year. Or when we pull the nalka, Pani's coming out. So, if it rains too much, it floods. But what they don't understand is the experts, and this is not me saying this, experts, groundwater experts, have said by 2039, Punjab is going to run out of water in its major cities. The opening, I went to the United Nations Water Conference, which is a once in a generational event. The first one was in 1977, and this was the one after. There was thousands of organizations, NGOs, every country was there. And, you know, unfortunately, there was no one there from Punjab but myself. And, you know, me, I wouldn't say I'm the most expert person to be speaking on the issue. I've done my study, but I wouldn't say I'm not a PhD level expert on groundwater issue. I do know Punjab's issue at quite an extent. And the opening statements at this conference on a world level was the biggest extractor of groundwater in the entire world is India by a high margin. And I just read the 2022 groundwater kind of extraction reports from India. And for the last 5 years, Punjab has been the biggest groundwater extractor in India. So by default, I was just sitting there thinking, wow, Punjab is the biggest groundwater extractor in the entire world. And how many Punjabis know that?
Just a level of denial then, isn't it, really?
You saw it. I mean, even this week, right, there is this whole denial, and then probably down to some of the other factors you talk about, education and operate, how they operate in the Kasans. I think there was an issue yesterday, I saw it, and Lakas Dhanna went to a pind, and he was at this mortar, and he goes, this mortar had been running, Dubal had been running for 24 hours constantly, and it was going to carry on running because he had it on auto. And they even sort of pleaded with the owner to say, look, turn it off. And where was this water going? Was just into an empty field where he just sort of cut the kanak and the harvest, and he was just letting the water flow, just to flood it for the rice, which isn't going to come for another month or so. But it's just this, because they think they've, like you said, Gopi, because they turn the tap on and it's there, the thinking is, let me get mine before someone else uses it. And they don't see for the whole Punjab that all they're doing is just bleeding it. They're contributing. Obviously, let's not get away from this, right? It is the state that is taking probably 80% of the resources of Punjab free of charge as well, right?
So, the biggest extractor of groundwater in Punjab is agriculture. Yeah. And I think it's like 86% of the water is used there. And the government is intentionally or unintentionally, I'd say intentionally, because they know it's causing damage, has, you know, given support, minimum support, MSP on those crops that are the most water intensive crops. Yeah. Secondly, in terms of the groundwater, they give diesel free for those farmers to pump the water up. They give, you know, these pumps. Remember, the Punjab used to mainly be irrigated by canal systems, and these canal systems were full because the river waters were feeding them canals. Now what's happening is the rivers are kind of dry, so the canal systems are dry, and they promoted these tube. They give subsidies to get people to put tube wells in their,
and there's no meters. There's no meters on any of these as well, right?
So it's just no. It's free electricity to pump up. It's free, and if we come out and say this free electricity should be stopped or free diesel to pump up should be stopped, our own Punjabis would turn against us, saying, "Oh, look, you're killing the Kisan by taking this free subsidy away from them." But they don't understand that that is basically killing, you know, water for the future generations. But I was doing a calculation the other day. Punjab has a 50,362 square kilometer, out of which is cultivatable land is around 42,000. So that's cultivatable. Out of that cultivatable land, what is being cultivated is around 40,000. So out of the 50,362, around 40,200 is being cultivated. Around 94% of what could be cultivated is being cultivated. Out of that 40,000 square kilometers, we have got around 1.6 million tube wells. And I was doing the calculations of how many tube wells is that per square kilometer. So per one square kilometer, that's like 16 tube wells. And it's just, it's shocking. Yeah. Absolutely shocking. And
well,
if
we
you
haven't seen it in our pens, right? You go in your pen and it's like, well, I've got two kids there. I need my own tube well, or I don't get the rent for it. Or then he's got it. So like I said, you can visually see, you could count probably 8 to 10 just in your eye line, right?
Yeah.
And again, it was never an issue in the past. And I think this is the big thing around the Bhakra Dam and the building of the tunnels and the SYL canal to Rajasthan and Haryana. These are massive issues that deplete the resources of Punjab, which have force the farmers to, like I say, dig these deeper holes, and it's necessity, right? Mm. And it's like, if you tell them what's happening, they'll understand it, but they've still got to eat tomorrow. There is no alternative, and we've seen that with the farmers' protest, is that as soon as you throttle them, there is nothing else they can do. And with the mass migration, some of the other issues you highlighted, that's all they know. And it's a real social dilemma for all Punjabis of actually what does the future look like. What are the next generation going to be doing there?
Was there any India representation at that UN conference then, seeing that India was such a headline? Out of curiosity,
There was India was there. There was India sponsored NGOs there. There was no one representing Punjab specifically. Mm-hmm. But in terms of India, India talks about there being a water scarcity in the entire country, and there's an issue overall, but they never mentioned Punjab. And anyone that kind of wants to understand the scale of the issue, just go away, go on an academic database, type in Punjab, India's groundwater reports, look at the last few years, and you see what scale Punjab is compared to the rest of the country. I think Punjab this year was 164% extraction rate. You know, it should be anywhere under 80%, so that the ground has been replenished. We're at 164%. That's because we've got two crop cycles. We've got the Kharif and the Rabi. We're basically over-exploiting our ground nutrients. We're over-exploiting, the energy. someone explained, I was speaking to a farmer in Punjab, and he was talking about the soil fertility, the water retention of that soil is so bad at the moment because of these artificial chemicals that we've been pumping into the soil. And he's like, "Ethidi mitti is mari hui lash ya." Like, it's basically just like a lash that you're pumping the coon into, and kind of it's on an ICU ventilator, and you're just basically keeping it going because you're pumping stuff into it. But without itself, it's not got the strength or the sustainability to actually grow and hold anything. And that was because of just like the Punjab's, you know, youth and the Nauja of Punjab were hooked with drugs. The same happened to the Jameen by the Green Revolution. These free pesticides, insecticides, these weedicides, these fertilizers were bought into Punjab. And they were given for free. They were given as like, you know, see what they do with your crops. And a farmer that's going to say, wow, this is, you know, increase my crop yield by 60%, by 40, 50%. They're going to think, wow, this is amazing. But they never explain the long-term effects of what these, you know, insecticides, pesticides would have on the people of Punjab, not just the ground itself. Because remember, if there's no influx of river water, what people are going to drink? People are drinking groundwater. Now, when you're spraying chemicals on your crops, when it rains, where does that rain go? It goes back into the ground. So leaching, bioaccumulation, biomagnification of them chemicals are then pumped up, are drunk. And then this is why NBC and other articles are talking about Punjab being the cancer capital of India. And, you know, don't believe me, open up your phones right now, Google just the words cancer train. Don't write Punjab, don't write India, don't write anything. Just Google the words cancer train. And it talks about this train that goes from Punjab every single night to a place in Rajasthan called Bikaner, full of around 236 kilometers every night, full of cancer patients.
Well, I just done it, treatment. And all the stories are India. NDTV, cancer train, shocking television, cancer train. Yeah, from Punjab.
Punjab, yeah.
Bhatinda.
So Bhatinda, Gopi, you know, with this, we've mentioned the United Nations and some of the shocking and blatant stats that are out there. What's actually been the response of United Nations, other organizations in the international community, the environmental community, towards India and towards these kind of, you know, these blatant stats around, you know, the pillarage of water from Punjab and obviously the subsequent consequences? Has there been any kind of questioning from these types of organizations?
See, the problem we have is because we're stateless, because we don't have actual representation to a level where people would take us seriously, there's no one to actually hold India accountable for the, I'd say, the human rights violations, the neglect that it's caused this, you know, civilization. If you look at international riparian law, you know, it's illegal to divert anyone's water away from the state. And you know, it's been diverted away from Punjab. You know, evidently starving up to 28 million people of water eventually, not including the health issues and many of the issues that have come because of the diversion of water. But who's to hold kind of India accountable? We can only, you know, highlight and talk. And us going there actually did ruffle a few feathers. It started the conversation with some countries that wanted to know more about the issue, some NGOs that want to help with intervention. But in terms of, you know, our own Punjabis now understanding, I think that's where we lack. We need every Punjabi on board understanding what is happening with Punjab. And not just understanding, now thinking, okay, how do we move forward from this? How do we prevent this from actually getting any worse?
And are you seeing that from that, on that point specifically then, are you seeing more studies, more analysis and investigation from Punjab universities, Park and the government, the agricultural ministry probably will counter all of this stuff. But even the NGOs in Punjab, are they sort of looking into this, providing the data? Have you connected with some of those?
Yeah, so we've kind of employed around 4 researchers on the ground there. And it's interesting, very, very interesting, the kind of blocks you get in terms of your ethnic cleansing. Like, you have to pass certain things to get certain amount of research done, and you get blocked by your own university, you get blocked by the authorizing body. A lot of the things that, you know, you want to kind of study are not very promoted like what things all are.
Right, so even the own state's apparatus and education are more involved in the cover-up.
Punjab's remote control is with Delhi.
Yeah.
Punjab doesn't have a say in anything it does. Chandigarh was the biggest university in Punjab. The administration of Chandigarh University, the main Punjab university, was given to the central government. You know, it in terms of what happens in Punjab, people need to realize now that Punjab actually has zero say in anything it does in Punjab. That is from the budget, that is from the education that's given in Punjab, that is from, you know, practically anything that you can think of Punjab is controlled by the central government. Punjab's the most in debt state at the moment. And, you know, if you can see the amount of debt that Punjab has, and a lot of that debt, like someone asked me the other day, like, why is Punjab in so much debt? And one of the biggest things that's caused Punjab's debt is when a military or a BSF or, you know, the army has to be deployed in your state, the state is billed that expense to the central government. And we're still paying the karja from the 80s, let alone the BSF being in now. And, you know, it kind of being in Punjab at the moment. But you can see the kind of the level of neglect where we were once number two, number one in GDP. Now we're 17th. You know, how far we've dropped in our... And it's because agriculture is unsustainable in the longevity. Around the UN report suggests that 10,000 small-scale industries left Punjab in the last two decades. That's 10,000 small-scale, medium-scale industries that have left Punjab. If industry has left, why did industry leave is a big research topic in itself. It was something that was created throughout India called special economic zones. These economic zones were created to have free electricity, tax-free, these subsidies, and these kind of companies were incentivized to say, look, you go to this place and you can, you know, make so much more profit rather than you stay in India.
We saw that first time when I was with Accenture, and the big outsourcing trend was kicking off. I think it was a senior partner was friends with HP, Hewlett Packard, in the US. And he was a Punjabi. And he wanted to invest and open the first contact center, one of the earlier ones, in Punjab. And he was so difficult. Unbelievably. It was a bit naive, but we've done this stuff around the world, right? So he knew there would be challenges, but it was all at HP's cost, all at their terms of build infrastructure, the roadworks, public transport, all of this stuff. And they just wouldn't let it happen. In the end, they just pointed him to Bangalore, Chennai. That's where they wanted it. And that's now where you have the mega operations, right? Everyone has their contact center out in Chennai, in Calcutta, in Bangalore, in Hyderabad, right? But Punjab was supposed to be, because historically it had that academic credibility, a hardworking population, and that valued education. He was a product of that just in the US, and trying to give that back, it was just impossible. And if you magnify that now going forward 30, 40 years, you've seen that in the complete lack of investment in Punjab. There's hardly any industry.
I mean, this is everything just coming. I mean, for me, it's probably the first time I'm hearing a lot of this, I'll be honest with you, in a statistical form. And it's just that, you know, I come back to that whole denial and that whole... you know, we go back to India and we have this fun time as diaspora in our pens, in visiting our relatives, almost with rose-tinted glasses. They don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going on, you know, when you scratch the surface underneath. But, I mean, you know, good people, you've just highlighted, I mean, there's a ticking time bomb there, that there needs to be real awareness too. Do we have a role as a diaspora? I mean, I suppose being part of the diaspora, you've had a better chance of finding out these facts than being in Punjab itself. You've probably found out more and been able to gather more data, more effective data, than you would have if you were on the ground in Punjab.
I'll give you like a crash course in the next kind of couple of minutes to tell you the kind of scale of some of the issues in Punjab. So I'll start with social issues so you can kind of just have a bit of an understanding. Everything I'm about to say to you is backed 100% by data. Most of it is on our social media and our website. So in terms of social issues, 70% of the rural youth, according to the Gurunanak Dev University report is addicted to drugs, 70%. Even though our independent survey said 86%, they're saying 70%. Punjab, the first in the NCRB, National Crime Record Bureau report for drugs, second highest in alcohol, as I said before, third highest in overdose. 86% of households in Punjab are in debt. That's 86%. This is the ICSSR report. 44% of the total convicts under the NDPS Act in Punjab are from Punjab, and it's the highest in the country for out-migration. So out-migration per lakh, the India's average is around 159. Punjab's average is 850, fivefold more. Chandigarh's statistics are separate because they class Chandigarh as a union territory. It's 10,150 per lakh people are leaving Chandigarh. There's more fake agent travel agents in Punjab than anywhere else in India. So that's just the social issues. Human resources and environmental issues, around 75% of Punjab's river water has been diverted. The total influx of Punjab's river water is about 17.17 million acre feet. Punjab's only getting 25% of that. Rest has been given to Rajasthan, Haryana, some to Kashmir, some to Delhi. You've got experts that are saying around 82% of Punjab's groundwater blocks are in the red zone. Experts saying Punjab within 15 to 20 years will become a desert. Cancer rates highest in the country, as we just talked about. It's ranked the highest for the loss of forest land and forest land encroachment, which was kind of a huge concern, that we've lost so much flora, so much fauna, so many animals, so many ecosystems. So we've got the least amount of forest cover. We've got the highest level. This is last year. This is reports from the last 6 months. We've got the highest level of uranium contamination in the entire country, highest in the entire country for arsenic. Them to just find out the health effects of being highest in arsenic and highest in uranium, what that would do to the human body. We are the second highest in fluoride content in our water. And fluoride, everyone knows what that does to brain development, just research on it, how that is affecting. 29% of the 5,000 or so wells that were dip tested were unsafe for drinking. Many of the school tests that were done in places like Muktsar said that the water was not drinkable, but the kids were still drinking it. Health issues that goes on to Punjab is the highest in the entire country for hepatitis C. It's highest in the entire country for hypertension, is highest in the entire country for obesity, is highest in the entire country for heart disease, ischemic heart disease, is highest in the entire country for aged 45 plus with eye-related problems, and it's the second highest for diabetes-related deaths. Punjab has got the highest in transport consumption in the entire country and is highest in HIV and AIDS. Punjab is also one of the kind of biggest in terms of farmer suicides. Talking about mental illness, they say that 1 in 8 people in Punjab suffer from mental illness, but only 20% of that 1 in 8 have ever had access to any treatment. This is from the National Mental Health Survey India. 19% of the foods tested in 2022 were below standard, unedible. 19% of foods tested throughout Punjab, unedible. That is by the PHFWD report. Punjab has the highest medical expenditure in the entire country. That's higher than the capital, Delhi. To spend a night in hospital, the NSSR report showed that Punjab was the highest to spend a night in hospital. 90% of the children in Punjab lack a healthy heart style due to the recent reports. Punjabi, the language, is diminishing according to many reports by UNESCO and others. 70% of Punjab's schools are privatized and are paid by people. Public school is practically inadequate in Punjab. Only the really poor go to public school. The DISE report says that Punjab has the poorest of average for 4 classrooms per school. So it doesn't have the facilities. The NHRC issued notice to Punjab government over the no access to proper proper education facilities in some of its villages. Religious, you know, going down the religious and understanding the religious problems. We all know how there's been a sharp increase with in Biadabiyan, in kind of Sakhalin, in Punjab. You've got history being distorted on a mass scale, whether that's, you know, kind of painting the narrative that Sikhs were, you know, are just long-haired Hindus, Article 25B. You've got these textbooks in Punjab, five textbooks. Go on our website, you'll know exactly what the five textbooks are, saying things like Guru Arjan Dev Ji committed suicide, Guru Tegh Bahadur Ji went to jail because he was a thief, Guru Har Gobind Sahib Ji was a darpok, so he slept with armed people at his bed. Guru Gobind Singh Ji couldn't hack that four of his sahibs that they were shaheed, so that, you know, he also committed suicide. Guru Nanak Dev Ji was a gaupag. Guru Nanak Dev Ji believed in the Hindu rituals. Banda Singh Bahadur was a rapist. These are books that Sikh history books that have been studied at A-level equivalent in Punjab schools, throughout Punjab schools at the moment. So everything I've just said that is backed by data on our website. You can go check out. I probably missed loads of things out when I've been saying that as well.
I think the stuff you've covered, I think that if that's not a wake-up call to every Punjabi, whether they're from living in Punjab, working here, or second, third, fourth generation here. I mean, and I think the things you touched on last, Gurpreet, is probably the reasons why some of the others have been not had the same level of exposure, is because as Sikhs, our guru is our everything. And because they went for the religion first, they targeted the Tharam. And we've been fighting and coming to terms with that since the 80s. And it's the easy ploy for them. They know whenever they want to distract the Sikh community, they just will initiate a Biadabi. They'll initiate some desecration. They will focus the whole Sikh community on this line. The prisoners has been ongoing. The struggle for Sikh freedom is ongoing. And therefore, it's managed to paint the whole population as extremists or uneducated. So therefore, anyone who speaks on the other four issues that you touched on, education, health, resources, and social issues, just gets discredited or doesn't get airtime. And it just doesn't. And when you have a government that is covering up these issues, you then don't have any authority to speak on this. And therefore, who are we speaking to? Who is listening? It is individuals, volunteers. Comes back to that sevadar, that actually is a group of individual volunteers, part-time volunteers, are driving these massive global issues that are governmental level issues out in there to the world. I mean, it's massively commendable, the Seva Saving Punjab and you and all the other Sevadars have been doing, because it's bringing this out there. And no educated individual our generation has got any excuse to not know this stuff and research it them further, right?
Yeah. I mean, you look at Amritpal Singh as well. I mean, you know, he was raising a level of awareness about all of these issues as well. And look what happened to him and that movement, and how that has been quashed or attempted to be quashed, you know, by being imprisoned all the way thousands of miles away in Assam as well, in order to silence that that dissent and that awareness that's going out there. So you're right, it's distraction after distraction. That's all it is.
I was going to ask the question, like, what in terms of who is going to raise this for us, right? I mean, if we look at the UK, you've got environmentalists, the activists, the climate activists, right, who, if they had this level of information and this level of knowledge and factual, you'd question, why is there not a massive uprising from the environmentalists there? And for a Punjab and a Punjabi, there is this, and whether you agree with it or not, the reality is the Punjabis are more tuned into artists and actors than any economist, any agriculturalist, any scientist, or anything of that ilk.
And any artist that starts to talk about
exactly,
history,
like, there you go. And we can see that, right? Deep Sidhu, Sidhu Musiala, right? Anyone who started to touch these issues, because when you're born from there, you can't escape it. Bang, elimination. And I think that's how people need to connect these issues, that as soon they're happening, and as soon as they start to raise the voice of these and highlight, put the spotlight on it, that's the extent the government will go to. It is direct elimination.
That's right. And Gopreet, I think as we mentioned, we've seen the correlation between people who raise these issues and the kind of issues they face in response, and ultimately, you know, in the case we spoke about, is death. In terms of, and Montgomery mentioned it earlier, it's been mind-blowing, some of the stats you've spoke about. No excuse for kind of Punjabis not to kind of at least kind of familiarize themselves with what's going on. But what's been your experience and the organization's experience about, you know, people who are trying to stop what you're doing? Because obviously you're very data-led, which really what makes you different from other orgs is hard primary data. What kind of issues, whether it be on social media or outside of social media, have you seen in terms of trying to put a stop to what you're doing?
I think there's a lot that's happened, and I don't normally talk about it because I just always think I'm irrelevant in this. I'm going to carry on doing the seva. I mean, there's threats, there's, you know, there's things, let's just leave it at that. There's things that have happened, and they've been directly because of...
But you've had the same targeting on social media as well, right? The same censorship issue.
Yeah, the council being shut down, council not being able to be seen in places like India sometimes. You know, there's so many things that happen, but I think it's more the problem that they feel. The data-led approach shows accountability. It shows, you know, the scalability. It shows that there is, you know, evidence and there's data that's backing this silent genocide, as I would call it, happening in Punjab. You know, you kill someone with a bullet, everyone's like, oh, you know, he was shot. You kill someone with poison, everyone's like, oh, well, yeah, he died. You know, I think Punjab has been poisoned for the last 30 years covertly, and we just only remember the overt stuff that happened in Punjab. You know, they changed the way they wanted to do things. You know, they either poisoned us while we were there, or they migrated us out, so we're not an issue for them anymore. Because while we'd always be there, you know, we'd always stand by the guru's philosophy. The guru's philosophy was to always challenge injustice, challenge tyranny, whereas the Guru Nanak Maharaj called Babar Jabbar. You know, it's always been in not just Sikh, but Punjabi blood to challenge where injustice is happening. And while we always stand by our principles of we have our own sovereignty, as a Sikh, Maharaj always, he gave us our own sovereignty from when Guru Sahib, you know, made us Patshahs. He said, Agreeb Sikhan ko deo Patshahi. And I think that's always going to challenge. We're always going to be challenged on that, you know, wherever we are, in terms of who we are and our identity.
Do you think the reverse migration is what Amrit Pal used to talk about as well?
So there's loads of things. There's loads of things that I want to come on to in terms of like moving forward what we can do. And I think this is something that we always kind of fail to focus on. We all know the issue. We know the symptoms. Now we're starting to look. I mean, some of our researchers, just kind of, if anybody out there, they don't have to be an academic researcher. They could be anywhere and help us in any way, whether that's, you know, creating content, whether that's translating stuff, whether it's whatever it is. If you feel like you can help, please reach out. We've got around 20 volunteers at the moment, and we're building our team, because the more that we know, the more information we're collecting, the more that we're archiving. Like I spoke at the UN, I referenced a certain article, and that article disappeared from 5 or 6 databases. And I was just like, wow, how can it just disappear? So if we've got things archived, they can't disappear online either. It's this, you know, the Saving Punjab organization is looking at now, thinking, okay, how do we now tackle the issues on the data that we've collected? So there's loads of ways of putting solutions into the issues that you have. Every problem has a solution, but it's about how do we as a Punjabi in the diaspora implement that within Punjab, especially when we're probably not welcome there at the moment. How do we take that to the average Punjabi and give them the empowerment of actually thinking, you know what, it's not the government, it's the people that create the change. We, everything that we've done so far or we want to do in the future, we don't want the government policies to change. We want the people to create the change on the ground, because the people are the ones that hold the power. Now, kind of, without going into the nitty-gritty of what the solutions are to every single problem, whether that's environmental, rainwater conservation, or kind of crop diversification and the sustainability within the environment, or whether that's rehabilitation centers and kind of dealing with the reverse migration and investments in, you know, kind of going away from agriculture and bringing that investment back into Punjab. And because all these kind of are specific to specific areas and specific issues, and that intervention that's needed on across so many issues, whether that's health, whether that's social, whether that's religious, is too big to paint with the same brush. So we worked backwards. We've now discovered kind of and done vast research on what the problem was. Now we're thinking, okay, how do we implement the solution so that the intervention is specific on a village level? So we are now kind of in the pilot stage of launching something called the MyPaint project. And the MyPaint project is basically going to hopefully cover everything that we're studying and we're looking at Punjab. Now, It's going to come in a few phases, and I'm not going to explain phase 2 and 3 at the moment because it's kind of like a whole podcast in itself. But I'll just briefly explain phase 1 of the MyPaint project, and we're hopefully going to launch that later this year. So the MyPaint project is it's a data-led, basically, beginning. We've looked at models of how people have done, certain stuff like this in villages in Africa, and how they kind of built kind of these sustainable villages within a community by using a data-led approach. Now, the actual project itself starts off from, like, say, Jassing, you come to me and you say to me, I'm going to sponsor my village. And the sponsoring of your village starts off with something called filling out a referral for your village. So what all that entails is you get a referral form, which will be on our website, and you say, my name is Justin, this is my village name, and I want to sponsor and pay the fee to have my village surveyed. Now, we have basically created a team on the ground that's going to go into your village and spend 6 days in that village. And the kind of in-depth report that they're going to analyze and take out from that village, you're talking looking at the soil fertility, looking at the water contamination, looking at the kind of what the school systems are like, whether the school systems need electronic whiteboards, whether they have the toilet facilities. I'm talking this report. 6 days they're going to spend there. They're going to have focus group meetings. They're going to speak to the panchayat. They're going to look at the gurdwara systems. They're going to go as far as holding in one of the days a health camp. So the health camp is people coming and getting their biodata check, getting the bloods tested. And what we're doing from that is collecting the data to understand what the health of the village is, what kind of disease are in the village, what the diet of the village is. Is there any mental health issues? Is there something that's common? Is there a correlation between the village where they've all got a certain type of disease or cancer? And that basically gives us an understanding. It'll be a really in-depth report for village, specifically for your village. And that's kind of phase 1, understanding on a village level what the issues are. And at the back of that report, we will understand the kind of red, amber, greens, what kind of things that really need to be worked on at the moment, whether that's, the water issue in the village, the water groundwater is depleting there, or the agriculture systems need reforming there. There needs to be a promotion of organic farmers in your village. There's a system that we're creating around that. There's a system around household rainwater conservation, sewage systems, energy sustainability, solar farming. Like, literally, it's about future-proofing your village to have a model village in your village. But the people in the diaspora, once that report is generated, they will see the action points that need to be created on the back of that report of what needs to be done in your village. Then that goes on to phase 2 of actually implementing the change. And then phase 3 is more about the accountability, the measurability, the scalability of understanding, has that change been created?
So even coming back to phase 1, Robbie, I mean, that is probably the most pragmatic and tactical sort of outline that I think actually goes right to the grassroots of Punjab and understands bend by bend. And there will be similarities in regions and districts and all the rest of it, but that's also a huge task. If we even think 15 to 18,000 bends across Punjab, spending 6 days in each, again, it takes a huge effort and manpower to support that and operationalize and mobilize that. So, but I think it's essential, right? I don't think we have a choice, is the reality. If we listen to this podcast, and if anyone's paid any attention, and we've only scratched the surface with some of the stuff you've touched on, right? That this isn't an option. This isn't a choice for us anymore. And actually having a tangible approach is, I think, is something that everybody needs to highlight, get behind. And certainly the more wealthy in the diaspora, I mean, it's just there's no excuse. And I think it's just, we got to get over this negativity in our own minds to say, oh, you know what? Nothing's going to happen. We have this defeatist mentality and a lack of sort of any excuse not to spend money, yet people will go to Punjab and just throw it in the air after a couple of glasses. I think we have to really realize our priorities around Punjab and stop dancing around our future and actually invest
in it. We've got some big organizations in the Panth. In our Panth, we've got some big organizations. All we want to try to do is, when that data is then taken in, we just share that data with these big organizations that want to do stuff in Punjab and say, look, you want to do stuff, this is where it needs to be done.
Here,
you want to
put here, yeah.
Yeah. So we're not saying, we have always thought of Saving Punjab is not going to be the organization that says, we'll do it for you. We want to guide the organizations that are currently, you know, taking in the millions and make to use it towards an efficient way that it can be used in Punjab. And that's accountable as well. You know, they've not collected millions and they say, okay, ek print jaake darakht laata, and that's it, take a picture and we've done our job.
We've got to get away from this taking pictures of vulnerable families and posting that out. I mean, great, West Sava's done it and we need to encourage it, but on this level, like you said, a data-led approach is not one person's opinion, right? It's not political. It's not that group. This is the facts and the reality. And I think
the accountability that comes from the back of that will show if that work's been done or not.
Yeah.
That's the kind of the main point of it, is if organizations do say, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z villages, then we will make sure that work's been done.
But you've got that self-vested interest as well. If it's my bend, and it's bad, then you've got personal responsibility to save your bend, and you're going to make sure that stuff's done, or if it hasn't done, follow up with it, rather than that being just, oh, I gave the 50 quid or 100 pound on online and that's my save I done. No, you've got to physically get involved, right? This is how things are going to change.
So phase two kind of comes around then, the reverse migration plan, you know, with the investment, with the kind of, once the structure's been, you know, built for our modernizing and future-proofing our villages, then the reverse migration, where we kind of commit, you know, 6 months or 3 months a year, where we start saying, I'm going to go live there for 3 months. And we kind of, you know, I think if you look at the Jewish model and the Israel model, they invested back in their, you know, the brain drain and muscle drain that they'd had. They put them back in and gave them they gave them incentives to say, you know, we're going to give you, you know, so much extra.
I think we've lost the sound on Gurpreet.
I think you just muted by mistake, but I think we've got you back.
I got a call in the middle of it. Are you back? Fine. Can you hear me?
You're back.
So they, I can't remember what I was saying. I'm sorry.
It's just the Israel thing again. Tax incentives. And people do all over the world, right? It's like,
absolutely. Yeah. Go back home scheme.
Yeah,
go back home scheme. And I think that kind of comes to a later approach, where people can start seeing that Punjab's a little bit, you know, becoming more stable. Bible. There's work being done.
Because we always got to realize, whatever thing we think, the state is multiple steps ahead. And then you look at this whole gang culture, which is the new phenomenon. Punjab is unsafe for anyone in the diaspora. Because you had this stuff after the shocking death of Sidhu Moosewala, and these people then are thinking, you know what, there's gang culture everywhere. I don't want to go back to Punjab, get everybody out. Again, there's this, whenever you see these initiatives and positive programs, you will see the reaction to it. But I think it's where we've got to be smarter and actually stay connected to your bend, which is why I really like that my bend analogy and approach, is that you will get the latest cover from your bend. And it's interesting how, if you watch the news and then you phone back home and you realize what's happening, it's worlds apart, the reality to how it's portrayed. So
Good piece. I mean, what
about overcoming it?
Yeah, I mean, what you're doing is it's phenomenal. Any other work in that respect? I mean, I'm grateful. I think we're all grateful that you've shared all of this on the podcast. But you know, I'd go on record to say this: there's very few visionaries and very few people who have a sort of an idea and can really map it out and execute it in that way as well. And you know, I had huge respect to how you've thought this through, how you're pulling this all together, and how you're actually thinking about a future plan here as well. That's, you know, generations ahead. So, you know, just grateful for the Teva.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think, again, just touching on Jazz's point about not giving people an excuse not to get involved or to come out with usual negativity, I think Saving Punjab is definitely out on its own in terms of the data. And we've all said, everyone can have opinions, but you can't argue with numbers and data. So, you know, I think it is, you know, the diaspora is great to go back home and, as just been said, spend money in various ways, whether it's building a house or whatever you're doing, buying a car. I think I would really urge our listeners to really look into getting involved into this My Bin project, because I think, it, you know, as Munkumal said, it's completely visionary and it really gets to the crux of the matter. And, you know, based on, even though Saving Punjab has only been going a few years, I think your credibility is undeniable in terms of the data-led approach and the fact that you're going to do what you say you'll do. So, I mean, just on that, Gopreet, where is the best place for people to go to kind of express? You've mentioned the website, but is there anywhere else about expressing their interest in getting involved?
So an email I'll show you guys is quite simple, info@savingpunjab.org. You know, that comes straight to our administration team that can direct it straight to me. And, you know, if anyone on our social medias, mainly Instagram and Twitter, they can kind of inbox us on there. That'll come straight to us as well. But if anyone desperately needs to get in touch, Jazz and you guys have my number, you can, you know, get in touch with the people on this podcast and they'll forward the contact. If there's anyone that really wants to get in touch as well.
I think that's the key point, right? Everyone, we all have a connection to Punjab. And we saw with the farmers protest that no matter what generation you're from here, you have an affinity to that land. It's the land of our gurus. Whether we're born here or born in another country, Punjab is still our homeland. When everyone asks where you're from, it's Punjab. And I think it is upon us, this generation and the generation after us, to really come up with, like you said, pragmatic and fact-based approaches that will address the fundamental issues of Punjab. I think there's sufficient work on the Tarmac side, and we have the challenges and the failed leadership there, but actually it shouldn't distract us from the basic needs of Punjab as well. Because when you speak to any Punjabi, whether they want freedom, what they want is these basic things addressed. And when you pull all five of these together, that ultimately is your sovereignty by default. So I think we've just got to look at this differently. And that's how we're probably going to take the majority Punjabis on this journey, as opposed to just the independent-minded Gursikhs. I think we certainly have to change our perspective a little more. And this is a great boost and waking people up. Your former friend, whichever friend it is, we all from, five of us on this podcast, we all from different friends. That's five friends right there, right? And if you just magnify that out to everyone listening, suddenly you start to get the ripple effect and the impact of change upon change.
And our team's small on the ground, but if we're getting more referrals, then we will increase our team on the ground. It's just kind of the fee that people will be paying for a referral will be going towards the team that's going in and doing the ground. So more referrals will probably just mean an increase in team. But like what you said is that Punjab is so important for us. Anyone listening to this podcast that's probably, you know, might be from a Sikh background, is even more important because 75% of our Qaum live there. And you know, if anyone that says, "Oh, we should be invested back in the Panth," well, the Panth is Punjab, and if you can't invest in Punjab at the moment and making that home for our Panth, fruitful and flourish, then the future of the Panth won't be in Punjab anymore. And it's really important that we, you know, the history we preserve, our history and heritage. 9 of our 10 gurus were from Punjab. And, you know, the historic preservation is important for us to transmit our history to our future generations. And we don't want itihas becoming mitihas. You know, we don't want history becoming mythology. I'll give you an example. Every civilization on the planet went where there was water, whether that's the Yellow River in China, whether that was, you know, Indus, where Punjab kind of was the flourishing lands there, and the River Nile in Egypt. Now, why did the people, you know, why did that the people around, you know, Egypt and around the River Nile, why did they not survive? Because the River Nile dried up. It was drought and other things that caused that civilization to kind of finish there. And from the back of that, look how much the history of, you know, Egypt has become mythology. People are saying aliens created the pyramids. Some people are saying, you know, they were made like this. Because that history wasn't preserved, we now have got such a big conspiracy theory or, you know, real, we don't understand what happened with the pyramids. So we don't want our future generations not knowing about Punjab or the history of Punjab because we couldn't preserve Punjab. And kind of coming back to it, just preserving, just language in itself, you know, the language, they say language is so paramount for future civilization. Language is the base of culture, the base of behavior, the behavior of, you know, the trajectory of the way a civilization goes is based on its language. Now, how many of us Punjabis in the second generation, third generation here have actually lost so many Punjabi words, and how many the next generation, you know, kind of lose? I'll just do a quick test with you guys now, and those people listening can have this test as well. What's the Punjabi word for triangle?
Google it.
Tree something. I don't know. Well, look, Trikoni.
Yes, it is. But like, it's such a simple word. Like when your kid's learning, they teach them the ABC, they teach them the color, they teach them the shapes. How many of us can name our shapes in Punjabi? Varg, Panch Baj is a pentagon, a chakkar. You know, gold or chorus, like even simple stuff. I think Mankamal Singh, you might know this, but I'm going to ask Jas, what's a school in Punjabi?
School? Oh, now you put me on the spot.
Even I can't think now.
A student is, it is the apak, isn't it? A school is...
What are you saying? We haven't got all day.
Go on.
School is Vidyala.
Vidyala.
So I got Vidyarthi.
Yeah.
Vidyarthi is student. Adhyapak is teacher.
Yeah.
Adhyapak is teacher.
Close.
Yeah.
So there's loads and loads of words like that. We've just like simple words like.
I was gonna say, is it school?
Schooler. I mean, that's what we've ended up. We've ended up using anglicized words with a Punjabi
bastardized
accent.
English, isn't
yeah.
It?
Absolutely. And that's it. And we survive off that now. And we use that. And that's in our language.
So many people do that. So many. I do that myself. And it's a shame. Like I was on TV and I kept saying, Ede vich bobada riskia. And I was like, what's risk in Punjabi? What is risk in Punjabi?
Khatra. Yeah.
Khatra is danger.
All right. Yeah. I don't know what risk is. Yeah.
Yes.
I'd probably use khatra anyway. But yeah.
Mushkil is challenge.
It's a word that you wouldn't even have heard of before. It's called jokum.
Jokum. No, I haven't. Yeah.
Yeah, jokum means risk. And my grandparents knew what it meant. My mum had heard of it, but she never used it because they started using risk. And we've never heard of it. So like words like that have just been, you know, are disappearing. And it's words like that, then you start thinking, how many will we lose in the future generations? Because Punjabi is not the main language of Punjab anymore. They teach Hindi and English at primary and secondary, and Punjabi is the tertiary language. So if we're not focusing on our Maa Boli, then how are we going to access things like Gurbani? Like Gurbani got so many references to so many rich words that we've lost already, as in we don't understand what they mean. But like, imagine the future generations, if that language is not preserved, how are they going to access that Gurbani?
Yeah, and I think that's a critical and absolute, maybe we'll look into doing that. I think the whole Punjabi language and direction of where we're going and the risks, as you said, to the language. And I think that's an episode in itself. And we saw the census and how Punjabi had gone from the second spoken language in this country to now the fourth. It just shows you, and we're a minority here, but actually, how many of us in our own families our kids are really fluent in Punjabi. I think we, our generation, was because our parents didn't really speak English, so it was a necessity. But it's a challenge for us all, and I think it's something, again, we need to face head on. And rather than skirting around it and having a Punjabi school for one day a week at the Gurdwara, we really need to get serious about it. And that's something, again, I think we'll reach out and get.
I think you should do an episode in Punjabi, just.
Oh, I'm happy to. It's that's one thing I'm blessed with, and I thank my parents for it. Is Punjabi is not an issue. And you, come on, you've heard me speak Punjabi plenty of times on stage. Yeah. So, but no,
no, it's been. No, I was just going to say it's been. It's. I'm trying to find the words, but it's enlightening. But even more, I think we've only, you know, touched the tip of the iceberg, and I think.
It's enlightening, and there's a dark side to it as well.
That's
so complicated to explain.
Very dark, and I think with Gopreet, we could probably just do five podcasts on a variety of issues. But really, Gopreet, really take my hat off to you for kind of the work you're getting involved in, especially in the current climate. We mentioned about trying to install fear into the diaspora to come to Punjab. I mean, look, Jazz knows, I've got cousins who aren't even Panthic-minded. They don't even know that much about Amritpal Singh, next to nothing. And they're all, you know, ring me in Sukraj, we're a bit scared to go back to India. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. You know, you've not even, you know. So, but it just shows, it reiterates the point of what you made. So really, again, take my hat off to you and the team there for all the work you're doing, and really look forward to kind of personally getting involved and hearing more about the My Bind project, because I think, you know, it's got the potential to really you know, uncover a lot of things. So, but no, I suppose, you know, we could be here all night, so I thought it'd be a good point just to wrap this up. Thanks obviously once again to Jazz and Mankamal, even though you've both got nothing better to do on a Wednesday night, and know that. and again, once again, Gopreet, really, really appreciate you taking the time out. And we urge all the listeners, you know, reach out, you know, through the email, info@savingpunjab.org, and also through their social media channels and our social media channels, the Seat Network, to actually get more involved. If you've got any question about what we've spoke about today, or you want to get more involved in some of the projects that they're working on, we really urge all listeners to do. So, guys, thanks again for your time. And until next time, Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa.
Waheguru Ji Ki Fateh.
Welcome to the Sikh Network Podcast, a weekly podcast discussing current and topical issues affecting Sikhs across the global diaspora.